This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today you'll hear from San Luis Obispo's new mayor, Erica A. Stewart.
We can't be self-sustainable and we can't move forward if we're not all willing to be part of making the change.
Also, we'll take a closer look at the Slow Food Bank.
We're going to inspect every single can to look at the integrity of the can. We're going to look at the best by date. And then because we have nutritional standards, we're going to look for the sugar, fat, and salt content to make sure that that food meets our nutritional guidelines.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, November 1st, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. And Carl Bloser traveled to West Africa in 1969 with their two kids in tow. The CDC had dispatched Carl to help eradicate smallpox, a disease that killed more than 300 million worldwide in the 20th century. KCBX contributor Tom Wilmer visits with Santa Barbara author Bea Bloser about her new book, Vaccines and Bayonets, Fighting Smallpox in Africa Amid Tribalism, Terror, and the Cold War.
Hi, Bea.
Hi, Tom.
I'm so glad to meet you in person. You're
a
legend now in my mind. I could not put your book down. It was just captivating and riveting. And you have a deft way as a storyteller of talking to someone in a casual, conversational way.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. And thanks for having me on your show.
My pleasure. Your late husband, Carl, was involved in the CDC in an attempt to eradicate smallpox worldwide.
A successful attempt.
Yeah, yeah, that's double incredible. Now we just need to replicate that today with the new germ.
Yeah, to date, smallpox is the only human disease that has ever been globally eradicated.
And yet it was touch and go for a while, wasn't it? You'd think you had it stomped out and then like another fire startup. So when you guys left America, your first assignment was in Nairobi?
No, Kano, Nigeria.
And that's where the Biafran connection came in?
Yes, Nigeria was in the middle of the Nigerian Civil War at that time, commonly known as the Nigeria-Biafra War. We were not near the war zone because we were in the north. Of course, the effects of it, you know, and impacted the nation.
Yeah, and this is what, 1970?
1969 is when we moved there.
And so at that time, your husband Carl was involved with what is now CDC, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He was in the U.S. Public Health Service, working with the Indian Health Service and so on. And then he and I had always wanted to go overseas when the West African smallpox eradication measles control program became available through CDC, then he eagerly jumped on board.
And you guys relatively had no fear. I mean, you packed up your two little kids. How old were they, like three or?
Our son was four.
Four, okay.
And our daughter was 18 months.
Tell us a little bit more about your first duty station and what you guys did.
Well, in Kano, everything was fascinating to me. People talk about culture shock. For me, I just devoured everything. Everything was wonderful, exciting, but there were a lot of tragedies too.
Right. A real disconnect from a Midwest upbringing, right?
Oh, yes, from small town Oklahoma. There were three things that were hardest to see in northern Nigeria. One was, of course, the smallpox and the leprosy, the effects of disease, and severely maimed people. And the other was that women and girls were denied education. Many of them were. There were a few, if they came from a family where the father was in favor of girls being educated, then they could be in school. They had their own separate schools. So there were a few who were being educated, but many were isolated behind walls, and that was a hard thing to see.
In your journey, you relocated to Equatorial Guinea. your description of that place geographically on the earth, you paint a picture of this tropical paradise. And yet, what a disconnect in so many ways. Tell us about going there and the learning curve.
Well, when we got the brochures and all of the advance material from the State Department about this transfer to Equatorial Guinea, was just, oh, wow, like a Hollywood set. Oh, it's beautiful. That's just going to be...
Looks like Tahiti, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the brochures described the warm and friendly people and the waters teeming with fish and all of these things.
Which and it was and had been.
It had been,
yeah.
Yes. And then we arrived in a place that was... paradise facade, mm-hmm. and underneath the warm and friendly people were no longer allowed to have any contact with foreigners at all.
And this was a very recent shift in the culture there.
Yes.
When you guys arrived.
Yes. Equatorial Guinea had been independent for only 18 months at that time.
And it was under Spanish colonial rule before then.
Correct.
So they're very much... Spanish architecture and language.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, Franco's Spain was the colonial power, and Equatorial Guinea had been independent only 18 months at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who won the first presidential election, no one thought could possibly win the election. It was said later by some of their own people that when that election took place, many people did not know what a vote was. And now they would never need to know.
Right, right. And this guy, what his full name again?
Francisco Macias Nguema.
Uh-huh. And he had shades of Idi Amin, right?
Some historians say that he, in some ways, he was even worse than Idi Amin or Pol Pot.
By your description, I would agree with that. I mean, that guy was consummate evil.
It was such a tragedy for the people there. Obviously, a pretty challenging place to to live and work.
You were in the midst of that, of having people, neighbors, disappeared and never surface again.
Well, people did disappear because we weren't able to have any contact with the local people. We didn't really know we would hear about, you know, this person or that person
right.
who had disappeared.
And part of it was the fear of the local people themselves, petrified to engage in conversation with you and Carl.
Yes.
Because they would get taken away, right?
Exactly.
Just because they talked to you being a foreigner.
Right. They would even cross the street to avoid passing us on a sidewalk. And the sidewalks, the streets were almost empty.
Because people
that
were fearful to just go outside. Right?
Yes. So that was a really strange thing when you're used to all the drums and the rhythms of hearing the singing and the drumming and the... just sounds of life, and to be in an African place where there's just such silence in the streets and almost empty streets, and then the few people who would be on the streets would cross the street even sometimes to avoid passing near us and having any chance that someone would accuse them of interacting, even making eye contact with a foreigner. So,
yeah, but even square one, day one, I remember reading your belongings, your possessions were strewn on your front lawn, and soldiers are bayoneting your boxes.
Yes.
That must have been spooky.
It was. Mm-hmm. It was. It definitely was. Seven soldiers inside our living room with their bayonets ramming them into the boxes of things. I still have family photo albums that have
spear marks in them.
Yes.
Wow.
Holes from the points of bayonets.
Mm-hmm. And yet in the midst of that, Carl is taking off and going into the hinterlands to deal with smallpox eradication. Talk a little bit about his mission and his duties that he did daily, weekly.
Carl was passionate, and I would say thinking in terms of all of the people who were part of smallpox eradication. They were, to the very last individual, they were passionate about this job and absolutely confident that they would complete it, that they would be victorious.
There are a lot of parallels to today. I was fascinated to read about his mission of contact tracing as a critical tool.
The contact tracing was, it's part of what became known as the ring method of vaccination. It became apparent that you could not possibly vaccinate every single person in the world. For one thing, with the birth rate, the population is growing faster than you can get that done. But also, Dr. Bill Foege, who was just a giant of a man and public health hero, really, he developed this method of vaccinating based on, you find one case and then you find you vaccinate all of the contacts of that person, mm-hmm. and then vaccinate all of their contacts.
So that was total
and
key.
So you build a firewall around the virus.
And it worked.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, right. It did.
So smallpox, directly due to Carl and his associates, was eradicated worldwide. They succeeded.
Yes, they did.
That's really cool.
And of course, it is a different, the smallpox variola major, the variola virus is a different virus than the coronavirus. You know, there are several things about the virus itself that made it a candidate for eradication, as they referred to. There was no animal vector. It was only person-to-person transmission. The symptoms were visible, and you did not have asymptomatic transmission of the virus. And so those things contributed as well. And then in addition to the characteristics of the virus, you had consistent messaging, mm-hmm. you know, a system that was used worldwide. And besides that, you know, it was a different virus, but also different people. For smallpox, I'd say the rich nations knew that if you didn't vaccinate the poor nations, you were still going to be at risk. Mm-hmm. And so the rich nations had an absolute mission to also get the vaccine to the poorest nations in the world.
Interesting. So your time there, you were really sequestered for the most part in your home in town. But you were able once in a while to get a hop on a Convair 440, a 20-minute flight to a different world. Tell us about that break in your time there.
Okay. Well, as far as being sequestered, I would say you were sequestered not in the house, mm-hmm. but the town itself, the capital city of Equatorial Guinea at that time, was about 1 square mile, right. A little over 1 square mile.
And the shops had a dearth of anything inside, right?
Right, because all of the Spaniards had been evacuated. And so there was very little market for any of these products. Plus, they had been plundered and so on. You know, I was not afraid to walk in the streets and in the few blocks that we had, mm-hmm. but there was a limit as to how far you could go outside of the little town. And since we were on an island, and the only means of departure really was on the plane, it was kind of like being sequestered. Most of Carl's work was over on the mainland.
Right. Still in Equatorial Guinea.
Yes. Yeah. Equatorial Guinea consisted primarily of Rio Muni, the small mainland portion, mm-hmm. the island of Fernando Po at that time, it's called Bioko Island now, and the tiny islet of Annabelle, and all of which you could fit inside the state of Maryland and have a little wiggle room left over. So it was always just like a breath of fresh air to get on that little Convair 440, and then if it didn't skim the tops of the trees too much and you safely got to Cameroon, then you had the, you know, the music and the smiles and
what a disconnect, huh?
Yes, yeah. Right.
Oh my gosh, Bea. We've got to chapter one, the intro to your life journey. What a joy. What a delight. I'm so glad we got together. And
I appreciate so much the opportunity to talk with you today.
My pleasure. To learn more about Vaccines and Bayonets, the new book, and your world, where would you direct a listener?
Vaccines and Bayonets, it is available through most online booksellers.
What a pleasure.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you. I enjoyed being with you.
Me too. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We've been visiting with Bea Blosser, the author of Vaccines and Bayonets, a historical memoir about fighting smallpox in Africa and tribalism, terror, and the Cold War.
On today's Working Lunch, we have a conversation between the Slo Chambers Executive Director Jim D'Antona and San Luis Obispo's new mayor, Erica A. Stewart.
Welcome to Working Lunch, the Chamber's weekly series where we talk with community leaders, getting to know the person behind the work and the important things they're delivering. I'm Jim D'Antona, CEO of the San Luis Chamber. Today, we'll be having a conversation with the recently appointed mayor of the city of San Luis Obispo, Erica A. Stewart. Following the unexpected resignation of former Mayor Harmon earlier this fall, Mayor Stewart has stepped up and into this new role following her initial election to city council in November of 2018 and serving this past year as vice mayor. Her election to the city council eventually her appointment to the mayor of the city of Slo made her the first African-American elected to the city council and to serve as mayor in the city's history. In addition to her public service, Mayor Stewart has a full-time position at Cal Poly as the Assistant Director of Personnel and Marketing for Campus Health and Well-being. In line with her passion of helping people improve their lives, the mayor has served as a county commissioner, president of HRCC, steering committee member for the City of Slo's Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Task Force, and as president of the Cal Poly Alumni Association Board. I'm excited to talk to Mayor Stewart about what got her involved in politics, how she goes about her decision-making on the city council, and her priorities for our community. Mayor Stewart, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
What was your first political experience and what imprint did it leave on you?
Well, my first political experience was definitely at Cal Poly. I ran for my freshman dorm president, the residence hall, the beautiful red brick Santa Lucia. And it was the first experience I'd ever done anything in ASB, ASI, et cetera. So really an exciting experience. And that just led me off to all of Cal Poly, my entire Cal Poly experience from my freshman year to on to the board of directors, being elected for my college. It was the College of Professional Studies, which no longer exists. And then later ASI president.
That's pretty exciting and a tough gig trying to get young college people engaged in that voting process, I'm sure.
Definitely.
What made you pull the trigger then to get involved? Was there a defining moment that led you to where you are today?
For me, it was a combination locally and nationally. In 2016, we had an election with a very outspoken individual who was leading our country, and there was a lot of negativity around women and communities of color. There was a very large lack of civility locally and nationally. And, you know, there was someone who I've been friends with for a long time. Our kids have grown up together, and he was on Facebook and he decided to leave Facebook. And he did say, you know, I'm leaving Facebook. People are talking to me on here the way they would never talk to me in person. And he left Facebook. And I think that is kind of how politics has gotten People are doing the cancel culture. They are wanting to be as volatile as possible from both extremes. And I just thought, wow, if I can make any difference in what we're doing right now, I feel I can do it without being name-calling and extreme. And I wanted to try to help make a difference. So originally I wasn't planning on running for office. I was planning to support others. And then here it went.
What's the biggest difference between being a council member and the mayor?
Well, it's interesting. We all hold one vote, just one. But now that I'm mayor, people want to reach out to me first before reaching out to the city council. And I do meet, of course, with the city manager and the city attorney more often. I do meet with them first on the agenda review before the council does as mayor, because we're looking at how are we going to approach the agenda? How are we going to, you know, and I help lead and facilitate and guide what the agenda is looking like. Now, of course, I still need two of my fellow colleagues to agree on what goes on the agenda. But as far as just the process of how staff is working, and I can bring those questions to the city manager probably a little quicker, I guess, in this role now. But really, it's I think just the expectation that, oh, wow, you're mayor, so can you come to this event, or can you be here, or can you represent the city council here? And that's something that I try to continue. I will try to continue to open up to all of the city council. We're actually going to join a second grade class on next Tuesday, the 9th. And I'm excited because a couple of my city council members talked about attending as well. So I think it's going to be at least myself and one other city council member. So it's not just about the mayor. And I want students and everyone in the community to remember that leadership is not just in the tippy top position of any organization.
Downsides, you have to run more often. You're more the target of what is happening, of, you know, any challenges or concerns. Why were you interested then in stepping up into that role of mayor?
I at first didn't think this was the role that I would want to apply for. I liked the idea of being a city council member only. I work a full-time job, so I didn't know that I could handle the extra hours. And then when Heidi Harmon resigned, you know, I looked to my employer and said, is it possible for me to do some sort of adjustment in my hours? And so now I am 3/4 time. So I'm still full-time, but not full time. And so that allowed me the time to do it. But really the leadership aspect is, I know that I can do this role with civility. I know that I have the experience of many different aspects of my life that I think brings some of the empathy and understanding in this role that maybe some others in of my colleagues maybe didn't have. Nothing in a bad way, just that I felt that I had those things. And one thing I found also from being in the city council role before I became mayor is there are just issues that are from women or African-Americans or students that they have felt really comfortable talking to me because I do have some of their identities, and they wanted to share where they're at or talk to me because they know that I have at least some understanding of what they're talking about. So that I feel can also transfer into being the mayor.
Certainly. But one of the things that probably happens a lot in your role is misconceptions about what you can do or be as mayor. And what so far have you seen has been that biggest misconception?
I'll say even with the past mayor, I think people put things on this role that it's all our fault for XYZ. And there are rules that are coming down from the county, from the state, from the from federally that we don't have the ability to change. We just have the ability to guide within those rules. And I think that is a hard part to take is, I think City Manager Johnson says often, we don't build the housing. We try to make the housing as accessible as possible to those who are willing to build. So when we look at trying to increase affordable housing, it's really working with groups like Haslo and People Self-Help Housing and, of course, developers, and working with the state and different nonprofits and different governmental agencies that can help bring either some money into the community or help allow us to loosen zoning in certain areas. Even like childcare, we were able to open up the ability to open childcare in any location within the city. But before that, we weren't able to with zoning. Now, take it to the next level, we don't open childcare though either, right? I don't get to run a childcare on my own, or nor can the staff necessarily, short of some after school care. So how do we also go through and help with childcare going forward? It's by partnering with nonprofits, partnering with governmental agencies, partnering with the community as a whole.
Yeah, and I think you nailed it right on the head. Government can only do so much to lay the groundwork. Right. It's up to the private sector and others to then build on that to create the things that you're trying to do. And you can incentivize it, but all those things, but you can't wave the magic wand, right?
Right. I wish. Abracadabra.
Anyway. It would be great, I'm sure.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. The SLO Chamber's Executive Director, Jim D'Antona, is speaking with Erica A. Stewart, San Luis Obispo's new mayor.
So when you think about historically fictional leaders, are there any that you try to channel when you're faced with tough decisions?
I love this question because every time I've tried to think about this and I never come up with just one. I really look at all of our ancestors that we are learning from and growing from that gave the foundation to where we're at today. I look at past leaders that fought for voters' rights, women's rights, civil rights. I'm looking at everyone from a teacher, high school choir teacher, and he is someone who completely gave me a chance to open up a little bit from my shyness. And then I also think about my English teacher who we all had to read a biography. I'm sure you all did this in high school. And I learned about this woman. Her name was Merle Oberon. She was an actress. She was half Black, half white. And at the time, and the Black and white movies, she was able to pass. And talking about the work that she was able to do, or even I look at the Bible and the way that Esther was able to bring the Jewish people in together. So I look at, there's always someone in all of history that is giving the ability to have women to vote or people of color to vote. Part of what fuels me to even do what I do in elected office or in my volunteer work in the past is we can't be self-sustainable and we can't move forward if we're not all willing to be part of making the change. So the apathy with the frustration of all of the fighting and the infighting and the extreme, it doesn't actually help us move things forward. And so for me, I'm always looking at Martin Luther King and Harriet Tubman and all these people who really like actually did the work, but also helped others come alongside and do the work too.
Tying right into that, are there experiences specific to you or programs you'd recommend to people who might be interested in growing their leadership roles?
Leadership SLO is, of course, one of the greatest experiences in this community as a graduate of class 15 and a class member of class 19, that especially if you want to be local, because if you want to be an elected official that is local, learning about our entire county is really important to the work that we do. As elected official in any one city, what we do in our one city is not just it. We have to work regionally with all of the other cities, and then as well as the county, the state, the federal government. Early on in this year, Heidi Harmon wasn't able to attend the mayor's meeting. So back in January, February, I started going, and the camaraderie of all of the mayors in this county, we were really able to look at certain issues like homelessness, COVID recovery, economic recovery, housing. How can we work together and grow forward? And if we don't do that as a group, we won't be as successful. Then, when you get to the next part though, and you want to run for office, as a Democrat woman, I would obviously suggest Emerge California or Emerge America if you're not in California. There's also other great women-focused programs like She Should Run, Close the Gap. I hope that through the city, we'll be offering some trainings in the future of how to understand your city and how to understand the process of running. And then every year, of course, the city clerk, at least in SLO, will do a presentation about how to run, just the nuts and bolts of what to fill out, and Women in the Pipeline. I'm part of that group. I know that we have hosted some different events as to how to actually be part of running for office. Plus, there's wonderful opportunities to do things online through Zoom and good old library as well.
What about people who want to support elected officials? What's the most impactful way someone can help you do your role or any elected official?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many ways that people can help. Of course, during campaign in the city of SLO, we can only raise $300 per person. If you are a household, you know, let's say there's two partners in the household and you have a joint checking account, that's $600. Woo. So when you're raising, you know, $30,000 to $60,000, any amount of help financially is really good. But volunteering is one of the greatest ways. I am so, so thankful. In this last year, I think I've had 7 volunteer interns doing my social media. And one of the biggest disappointments for me when COVID hit, well, there's so many, but I mean, as an elected official, one of my goals was after the first year to really get out there and communicate with people more and help people know what's going on and get feedback. And with COVID and everything shutting down, it just wasn't possible. So I was really thankful that the different individuals who have helped me on social media helped me get information out, newsletters, social media, and then getting information back. Email is also, of course, great. We all are checking our email. You may not always get the email back as fast or at all, but we do take that feedback and know that that helps us making our decisions. And then if there are other ways that, you know, you'd like to help an elected official get the word out or give them your expertise. I mean, I'll tell you, I'm not an expert on everything. So I depend on people who have all different sides of an issue. You know, when we're talking about the new public safety center Tuesday, there are people that are very pro policing and what we're doing right now. There are people that are very not pro policing, and why and how we do this going forward as a community is really important to hear everyone's opinions. I had someone that helped me, you know, gather all of those articles that were going on when 8 Can't Wait, you know, back in July of last year, you know, and learning really what that meant and what the use of force and how we're in different places when it comes to what's allowed statewide and what we can change statewide and what we can change citywide. So, you know, looking at all of that, having someone help kind of gather all the information for me was so great.
The relationship between the city and the business community is incredibly important. We're so thankful for everything you've done for the city of SLO, all the work that's gone on to, you know, keep a vibrant economy. How can we work together most effectively? What does success maybe look like to you?
One of the things that I've always really appreciated is the SLO Chamber's involvement in the whole community, our whole county, really, because you're really able to get what businesses are thinking, what they need, what maybe barriers we might have. I know we changed a lot with our permit processing so it could be more efficient and more smooth. And that I know from some business members have said, wow, thank you so much. That goes much faster now. And therefore it's cheaper because they're not having to go back and duplicate work, which is fantastic. I know the Parklets was a major partnership between the businesses, planning and developing, Councilor Pease and city staff, so we could help businesses be able to still succeed. So I think similar to Parklets, what else is out there that the businesses need that we can be involved in and partner with and collaborate with? So I think just sharing with us what else you need as businesses is really important. Downtown SLO, I know that the association works really closely with the businesses. If you happen to have a business in downtown SLO or are about to, you know, get connected with them. They do great advocacy for you on your behalf to us. But truly just communicating what the needs are and if there's something that we're not doing that you see in another community that we could do, great. Let's figure that out. Let's look at those options. What works in LA may not work in San Luis Obispo, right? What works in Minnesota or New York may not work in San Luis Obispo, but maybe they do. So, you know, one of the things that I know that on a multicultural sense is the lack of multicultural food here and how difficult it is to, you know, just open up a brand new large restaurant out of nowhere. And there have been some really cool things, you know, the Santa Barbara Funk Zone. There's a place, a city named Troy in New York, and they have this multicultural funk zone, for lack of a better word. And these little pop-up businesses of delicious food and services for different multicultural needs. And that is something that we need the businesses to partner up with us on, because we again, don't open businesses and run them. So, you know, we really have to figure out how to work together. And even just having like the membership of SLO Chamber be willing to put the multicultural little symbol if someone wants to, or the Cal Poly alumni little symbol if they want to, it's a great way to connect and help those of us in the community know that we can support a BIPOC business because it's already right there. Hey, yeah, I'm identified as a BIPOC business. I want you to buy my product. And that's what we need to know is how do we help the community and how do we help the city?
What are some of the top priorities, you know, for the next year or in the next coming years for you? Any projects or investments you're really excited about?
Continuing that multicultural for a second, you know, DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion is one of our major city goals. And I know that there are students from Cal Poly that are actually working with members of the city and members of the community looking at a feasibility study of a multicultural center here in SLO. And I think how fabulous would that be if we could find a space where people can feel they belong? That only helps continue exude into the whole city, the whole county, and help people feel like, yes, I do belong here. Yes, I want my friends to come visit me here. Yes, I want my family to be here. And that's a fabulous option. I'm also really excited about, you know, the economic recovery and what we've continued to work on and will continue to work on of helping businesses and individuals and families succeed past COVID when there's still the rent relief program. And that's for tenants and landlords that are affected by COVID. And I often get responses from Five Cities Homeless Center, from the executive director there, that they are willing to go everywhere throughout this county and help people get access and get through all the paperwork and submitting all the paperwork they need to be able to get that funding from the state. It's there, it's waiting for you. How do we help people access the different resources for economic recovery? Also, the railroad safety trail is happening. I'm so excited about making it more accessible for people to get from home to work, to school, to wherever they need to be, by foot, by rolling and strolling, in whatever way that means to them. And hopefully sometime we can get more bus drivers and we can have better access to buses too.
I know that you've been a small business owner, worked for nonprofits, government, private sector, in addition to being a mom, arts community, active community volunteer. How does your extraordinary breadth of experience come into play when you're making a decision on the dais about these things?
Well, I think being involved in so much in the community, it's given me the ability to at least want to have someone to go reach out to and say, hey, we have these arts issues. Okay, I'll just reach out right now to someone from Vocal Arts Ensemble or Arts Obispo. You know, who should I go to? And that's a great start. You know, Kevin from SLO Repertory, you know, whatever it might be. And then when it comes to, you know, being a parent, our kids have gone to at least four of the elementary schools here. Another school that closed, that really helped be like alternative education, junior high, the high school. Of course, I'm very familiar with Cal Poly. So I feel like I have a lot of connection to different parts of education. So when people are telling me their challenges, I can at least somewhat understand what they're talking about. And it helps me also think about how I can help them get connected better. You know, when we talk about homelessness and housing, I don't want to share the confidences of my family and friends, but there are many, many of us who have been homeless in different ways. And luckily in my immediate family of four, we had some wonderful friends who helped us out during some of those really tough times. But then, you know, going through the county process of Department of Social Services and not getting much help at all, I also know that feeling. And that's, really disheartening, and it's really difficult, you know, or the city going through some sort of construction and all of us on the block except for Woodstocks closed at that time because our businesses couldn't handle the closing and opening of the street. So I understand that small business and what they're going through and want to help them in whatever way that I can, knowing there's limitations. Obviously, now that I know more of the city side of things, how can I help? And, you know, the affordable housing is still huge on my mind of how do we help more individuals who are working families, working individuals, having somewhat decent jobs. How do we get them housing as well as someone who has no housing and is living on the street or living on a couch or living in a shelter? So how do we help? And that's what I'm constantly looking at, is all of those experiences to help create hopefully some better solutions going forward.
Mayor Stewart, thank you so much. Been an honor getting to talk with you and getting to know the person behind the title.
Thank you for having me. It was a great time.
That was Jim D'Antona, the SLO Chamber's executive director, speaking with Erica Stewart, San Luis Obispo's new mayor. On today's nonprofit story, your host, Dr. Consuelo Mukes, focuses on San Luis Obispo County's food bank.
Welcome to the nonprofit story. This is Dr. Consuelo Mukes. Today I have Garrett Olson. He is the CEO of the San Luis Obispo Food Bank, whose mission is to work with a network of partners to alleviate hunger in San Luis Obispo County and build a stronger community. So Garrett, welcome to the nonprofit story.
Thank you so much, Consuelo. I'm very honored to be here.
Well, we're so happy to have you. This is an important time for us to hear about food and food security in our county and other areas. We think we know everything about the food bank, but tell us a little bit about who you are, where you are, and what you do.
I'm still learning a lot about the food bank, so it wouldn't surprise me that your listeners didn't have some morsels to learn as well. Our formal name is the Food Bank Coalition of San Luis Obispo County, because our footprint is the entire county. So from Napomo to San Miguel and from California Valley to the coast, we provide compassionate hunger relief and nutrition services throughout the entire county. Our formal name doesn't flow off the tongue that well. And so we were very pleased to be the recipients of the Verdin 24-hour give that other nonprofits have applied for, where the Verdin marketing company comes in and helps rebrand you. And we were rebranded as the SLO Food Bank. If I had a mulligan, I would have put county in there so people know, because we're located in the city of SLO, and the city of SLO is the county seat. Some people think that our food bank is for the city of SLO, and nothing could be further from the truth. We are here to serve San Luis Obispo County. I could tell you a little bit more about how we do that if you're interested. We have really two major operational means by which we provide our services in the community. And like a very agile and creative team, we invented and implemented a third distribution during the pandemic when we saw a population that was being underserved. So when we get food out into the community, one of the things I absolutely love about this food bank is our board years ago adopted nutritional standards. So when we're putting food out in the community, we're not just filling bellies, we're fueling bodies. And that is really important, because about a third of the clients that we see tragically are children under the age of 18, a third, and about a quarter of those who we serve are seniors. And so at both ends of life's spectrum, we know that nutrition is vitally important for growing bodies, and then for bodies that maybe aren't as agile and active as they once were. When we provide food, we provide healthy, nutritious food. We do that primarily through two methods, and then I'll highlight the third for you real quickly.
Okay.
So we have a small fleet of trucks and a small team here at the SLO Food Bank, and we will go out to about 60 different sites throughout the county monthly and provide direct hunger relief to families in need, families and individuals in need. And so we'll drive all over the whole county on a set schedule, and we'll set up in parking lots and churches and elementary schools. And we will provide what we refer to as a household unit of food. And that's somewhere around the order of maybe 40 pounds worth of food, half of which is fresh California produce, and the other half is nutritious shelf-stable food, so pasta and rice.
Okay, that's great. You know what? I want to just take you back a little bit on some of these points. You're giving us a whole lot of wonderful information, and you were saying that you had a third underserved population.
It was actually the seniors. Early during the pandemic, seniors are particularly vulnerable to the coronavirus, and they were sheltering at home, and many of them didn't have the social connectivity to get food in their homes. And so we started a pilot program with the county of San Luis Obispo to provide hunger relief to seniors that were isolating due to COVID. And then as that program came to a close, we discovered that some of those people actually met the financial need for our services and still were not connected to social resources to get food. So in the middle of the pandemic, we started a senior home delivery program, and we're serving over 100 seniors a week, and we have the capacity to serve 300 seniors a week. So we started that during the pandemic.
That's wonderful. So let's also talk a little bit about that criteria.
I think the most important thing is if people show up to a distribution or to an agency partner, we're not asking them to bring pay stubs or tax documents or anything like that. It's the honor system. And we believe anybody that comes to a food distribution, we're going to give them the dignity of providing them food. There are financial eligibility requirements, and we post those at our distribution sites. And so when people come, they see what the eligibility requirements are. They're according to family size. And so we'll just ask people to reference that. We do very little in the way of asking any questions or checking immigration status or identification. People aren't getting rich coming to a food bank distribution. They're getting healthy. And we have a very strong interest in making sure that we have as healthy a community as possible. So we want to make it very easy for people that are in need to get food.
I used to be one of the servers at some of those distribution sites, and it's such a gratifying experience. Also, how else can people come and get food?
One of the ways that we get food out in their community, in fact, it accounts for just slightly more than half of the food we put out, is through other nonprofits who we refer to as our agency partners. So everything from Boys and Girls Club, Salvation Army, 40 Prado and Echo Shelter, church groups that run pantry and congregate feeding operations, over 80 nonprofits. If there's a nonprofit in Slo County on the front line of hunger, they're a partner of ours. We provide bulk food to those agency partners so that they can run their kitchen and pantry operations.
Where can you find where you're distributing? How would I know where to go?
You can call us and we'll help you. But if you have access to the internet, you can go to slofoodbank.org. And one of the top links is locate food. Just go to our food locator, enter your address, and it'll show you all of the locations around you and the times that they're operating. Another thing that we did during the pandemic, we were not a distribution point or a pantry operation before the pandemic. We're in an industrial area. We're not in a neighborhood. And before the pandemic, we would rarely get people that would come here in need of direct hunger relief, maybe 2 to 3 a week. Pandemic happened, and we were seeing quite literally dozens of people a day, new to food insecurity, showing up in our doorstep, lost and hungry. So wow. we turned our conference room into a pantry overnight. And it was staff that did that. That wasn't driven by the CEO or the board. That was our team saying, we've got to serve these people. And so now we have pantry at our site. So we're not likely the most convenient place for people to go if they're, you know, if they're transportation challenged or they don't live in the area. But we now have a pantry and run our pantry operations Monday through Friday during business hours. So people can come here and get food, and we'd love to provide them with that compassionate relief.
So you're so responsive to the needs of the community. Great. If you are just joining us, this is The Nonprofit Story. I'm your host, Dr. Consuelo, and I have Garrett Olson, the CEO of the San Luis Obispo Food Bank, with us today. Garrett, how do you actually get your food? I know it's high quality, good food, but where does it come from?
That is an absolutely beautiful quilt work of outreach and effort and smart spending and relationship building. We get our food through many, many different means. We purchase food, and we purchase food in bulk. So we get it at a very significantly discounted rate than if you were going to go to the grocery store and purchase food for the food bank. You said, I'm going to buy $10 worth of tuna because that's good, healthy protein. If you gave us that $10, we could quite literally turn that into $40 worth of purchasing power. Mm-hmm. So if you've got tuna already in your pantry and you want to donate it to us, we'd love to take it. If you're going to go buy food to give to us, if you just make that donation online, you will significantly magnify your impact. But purchasing food is really a very small component of how we get food. So Glean Slo is a program of the Slo Food Bank where we send volunteers out into fields and backyards to harvest food that would otherwise go to waste. We bring in over 300,000 pounds of food through that operation. We also do food drives. We're just getting ready to embark on Season of Hope in partnership with KSBY, which is one of our large food drive efforts. We're going to be embarking on our turkey drive soon for the Thanksgiving holiday. So we get a lot of food through what we refer to as household scale donations. So food that comes in that isn't palletized. We have a lot of lovely partners that donate food to us as well. So like Tally Vineyards will send us excess produce that we don't have to go and harvest ourselves. We do this amazing program, and it's based on a new California law that is rapidly rolling out and accelerating its impact where large food producers are required to donate food to nonprofits to reduce food waste. And the target number that the governor set was he wants to see over the next year a reduction of approximately 20% of food waste. The sad reality about America, one, we are ostensibly the richest country in the world, and we have so many people that are hungry. The other sad thing is there is enough food to feed everybody. We just don't have the logistics figured out yet how to get food to all those in need. There is enough food going into landfills and going down garbage disposals that if we could figure out how to get that food to hungry people, we could feed all of America and you wouldn't need food banks. So we go to grocery stores and we pick up bread that's still good, but maybe they just got a fresh batch in and they give it to us, or prepackaged food that they've got fresher stuff. So we get food through many, many, many different means. A logistical challenge that we are really proud of the ingenuity and efficiency of our operations.
And this is all fresh food, right? I mean, sometimes people think with food banks, you might get something that's expired, but that's not going to happen, right?
That's absolutely not going to happen. One of the challenges with household scale donations when we get food that's not palletized is we literally will inspect every single container we get. So if you're a Boy Scout troop and you go out and you collect food and you give us 80 cans of food, we're going to inspect every single can to look at the integrity of the can. We're going to look at the best by date. And then because we have nutritional standards, we're going to look for the sugar, fat, and salt content to make sure that that food meets our nutritional guidelines. We don't want to continue to contribute to obesity and type 2 diabetes and coronary vascular disease that is so rampant in our country. And we do that by providing food that is healthy for people's bodies. We also don't want to create food waste. So when we get food donated to us that doesn't meet our nutritional guidelines, we have a very, very small footprint of food spoilage and food waste here at the food bank. So we will either turn that food into compost, or more likely, we're going to turn it into food for livestock. We have agreements with livestock producers. So we'll provide food for cattle and hog operations, and they'll feed it to their livestock.
And I think you also have a school meals program. Is that correct?
We have a great relationship with the school districts in San Luis Obispo County. They stand strong on their own. But there are times when we will get excess food donation and we'll quickly turn around and provide it to the schools so they can get it out through their kitchen operations. We tend to supplement the school meal programs. So in the summer months when kids do not have access to summer school meals, we have a program called the Summer Breakfast Bag Program. So while kids are not in school, we give them this cute little backpack. And each one has 21 different meals that a child could prepare without requiring an adult to assist. And they're nutritious meals and there's good variety. And we will give out thousands and thousands and thousands of those every summer. And during coronavirus, what we found when school became virtual, we continued that breakfast bag program. And so whereas it once used to be the summer breakfast bag program, now it's just the breakfast bag program. We started it in March of 2020, and we continued to run it until the end of this summer year as kids came back in school. They play a complementary role to the schools.
Mm-hmm. Making sure everybody gets served. You must have a lot of volunteers. Do you need more volunteers?
So we always need more volunteers. Our volunteers really are part of the magic of the Slow Food Bank. So we get audited on this number. It's not a marketing ploy. For every dollar donated, we turn that into 7 nutritious meals. How do you create a 14-cent meal? I get that question an awful lot, and people think, gosh, you've got to just be giving them terrible food. We're not. We're giving them great food. We do it because we glean our own harvest, and we do grocery rescue. But one of the big things that we have is this amazing cadre of volunteers in our warehouse and at our gleaning sites and at our distribution sites. We have, Consuelo, we have over 1,800 people a year. Some of those people will do it once a year, and some people do it once a week. So volunteering with us, whether you're interested in doing it outdoors at a glean or in our warehouse at one of our distribution sites, go to slowfoodbank.org and click on the volunteer link. We'd love to see people come in.
Well, I can verify that it's a great opportunity because I volunteered with Food Bank for a couple of years before. And you're right, knowing that food is going to someone is so important. And just one other thing I was noticing also is that you have a program where you're now looking to provide equity in food services in different communities. And I believe that's a new program that's going on.
That is a new program. And it has always been the heart of our organization to provide food equity. But right now we're really putting a concerted effort in having a critical analysis of the strengths and gaps, most importantly, the gaps in our services. Uh-huh. We are in the process of hiring a grant-funded position that's going to be our food equities manager. And this person is going to take a look at the root causes of hunger. They're going to take a look at our operations. They're going to help us figure out how our operations can meet the need of all communities. But we know there are communities, particularly Hispanic communities in our county, where we know, based on census data, that there is a high level of need, but we know based on our own experience that there is low utilization of our services, and tragically there's low utilization of CalFresh SNAP services. So you may be familiar with that, but CalFresh SNAP is USDA funding from the federal government that provides hunger relief in the form of a debit card where people can go to their grocery store and shop. We are one of the lowest performing counties in terms of CalFresh SNAP enrollment. So not only are we going to be studying hunger with a health equities manager over this next year, we're hiring a second grant funded position to take a look at why are we so low in CalFresh enrollment. So we're addressing the issue of health equity and our distribution, and we're simultaneously asking ourselves, what is it about our county that's causing people not to be successful in applying for the services that they need? And if you believe in those services because you it's in your heart to believe that people need help, or if you're more financially focused, on the financial side, the lost economic activity in our county by our low enrollment in the USDA funded CalFresh SNAP program is $50 million a year. Wow. So by us not having full enrollment, that's federal money, that's tax money that you and I paid. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't come to our community for our people that are eligible to use that benefit. So they're not going to our grocery stores and shopping for nutritious food that they need, which stops us from having that economic activity in our community. So if we could solve that problem with our county partners who administer this program, then not only can we get more food in the bellies of people in need, get them the services that they need, but we can also create more economic stimulus for our county.
Do you also need donations from the community?
Absolutely.
And I mean like financial donations.
Yes, financial donations, particularly for food banks, is magic. We always appreciate food donations. And for nutritious food, we'll always put it to its highest and best use. But when people make a donation to us, you put us in a position to be able to purchase food when we need it, exactly what we need, and we magnify the purchasing power by purchasing in bulk. And so anybody could go online to slowfoodbank.org and make a donation. I've been pretty good at talking people out of making a single really big donation. And I'll say, hey, instead of making that really big donation, give me a tenth of that, but give it to me once a month. Sign up and be a recurring donor to us. Because as you know, Consuelo, when somebody signs on as a recurring donor, as the budget planner in the food bank, as the CEO, when I have sustaining donors, I can start to plan for what my finances are going to look like in the out months because I can count on you being a recurring donor. So if you were going to call me and say, hey, I'm going to write you a check for $100, I'll say, hey, do me a favor, write it for 20, but do it every month this year. You give me $20 a month, I'm going to feed 140 people every single month a nutritious meal. I can't think of any other investment that will resonate with people's hearts more than that incredible math equation.
I've been speaking with Garrett Olson. He is the CEO of the Slow Food Bank.
We're the Slow Food Bank. Our big name is Food Bank Coalition of San Luis Obispo County.
That's it. That's the big name. Be sure to go to the website at slowfoodbank.org and find out about volunteer opportunities, ways that you can give, and more about the programs and the food distribution. And Garrett, thank you for joining us this afternoon on The Nonprofit Story.
Thank you so much, Consuelo. It was truly an honor.
And thank you all for tuning in.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. KCBX.org.